This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hello there and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast. The very best bits of today's show. Richard and Georgia with you on Wednesday, the 24th of May. What have we got for you? Going to kick off with some big local stories, including more jobs at Expo City Dubai, Saudi airports, and the new list from Michelin about restaurants here in Dubai. Then extended interview with Henk Potts. He's a market strategist at Barclays Private Bank in London. He was in Dubai in the studio answering your questions about everything from cryptocurrencies to the Indian economy. Finally, talking to one fintech company that's just got a license from the central bank here in the UAE. Remo Giovanni Abbondondalo is the general manager for this region at checkout.com. All that to come. First up, though, those stories. Let's talk about some of the local stories. We're flicking through the local newspapers this morning, and we had Michelin guide out yesterday for restaurants in Dubai. Georgia, what did we learn?
Yeah, we did. Good news for the restaurateurs of Dubai. Always very confused by that word. It's not, it's restaurateurs. It's got too many vowels and not enough N's, in my view.
Why they don't allow the N, I don't know.
It's very confusing. So I think it's a French. Do you think it's French?
French.
Let's blame the French.
We were talking about this a while ago, and I think I used the word restaurateur.
And it was fury.
It was my ex-boss. It was the guy who brought me to Dubai back in 1998, Ian Fairservice, who is a restaurateur.
He is indeed. Very good one with Maine.
With Maine, exactly. Yeah. And other great stuff. No strangers to a restaurant as a customer either.
Well, a restaurateur. Anyway, 11 restaurants have received one star. Two stars have gone to three restaurants. And then 17 venues have been chosen as part of its Bib Gourmand category. Now, that's my favourite category because that's where you get basically a three-course meal for about 250 to 300 dirhams. They're sort of reasonably priced. Whereas the other ones, I'm only going to the other ones if it's lunch. And there's a lunch deal because they are very pricey and pricier once they get these stars as well. So really interesting. So you've got 11 Woodfire, which I actually have been to. Great restaurant. Al-Muntahar.
And that's good because we like that. And I've been as well. When the list first came out, and I didn't know about it before. And my son said, oh, can we go to one of the Michelin starred restaurants? It's like, no, for exactly the reasons that you mentioned. But Woodfire is a small independent restaurant in Jumeirah One, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's unlicensed, which means you can go and you don't end up spending a fortune because you get yourself a mocktail and instead the focus is entirely on the food. And it is spectacular food. It really is one of the best. And I love the fact that the list is starting to recognise these homegrown restaurants a little bit more. I know that there were criticisms last year that there were too many multinational restaurants, you know, incarnations of restaurants that have been successful elsewhere, and that there wasn't enough focus on homegrown. And there's a lot more this time. So you've got two other couple of restaurants, Moonrise, which is a local, Avatara, that's in the new Atlantis, the Royal, that's an Iranian restaurant. And then obviously, this is part of a chain in some ways. Not a chain. I'll get into trouble for that. But Dinner by Heston Blumenthal is also one of the new winners of the one star. They also awarded green stars this year, which was quite interesting. And great friend of the show, Omar from Boca, has finally won I don't know if it is a green star, maybe it's a green leaf from Michelin. So huge congratulations to Omar on that. It's very exciting. But the big question, of course, from a business perspective, is what does it mean for the restaurant's financials?
And what do we know about that? What do your sources tell you?
Well, I looked into it because I was a bit like, okay, so what's the deal? And the general gist is that Joël Robuchon, who is the world's most Michelin star decorated chef, he claimed that the stars really were financially transformative. He says with one Michelin star, you get about 20% more business. And it also encourages restaurants to put up their prices, which of course means that they're making more money, I guess. So with one star, they tend to put up their price by 15%. If you've got two stars, guess how much it goes up by?
Tell me.
Look at the script. By 55%. Three stars?
Go on.
Guess.
Double?
80%. 80%. You put up your prices by 80% if you have three stars. So it really can be financially transformative.
Congratulations to all those who have won Michelin stars of one vintage or another. Shruti, continuing the aviation theme this morning, it is planes, trains and automobiles. Saudi airports booming.
Yes, so Saudi airports have seen a 42% rise in passenger traffic, and that's in the first 4 months of 2023. Of course, we know about Saudi's bid to bring more tourists into the kingdom. And this is in the latest figures. It says by the General Authority of Civil Aviation, they say the number of passengers jumped from 35.8 million in the first 4 months of 2023. And this is up from 25.3 during the same period last year. So a massive boost there for Saudi tourism. And I wonder how much of that is because of Alula and, you know, people traveling to see, which is what I like to describe it as, the Petra, but the untouched version of Petra.
Have you been?
No, I haven't.
Have you, George?
I have. Yeah. Alula, it is so much better than Petra. It is absolutely staggering in its beauty.
I'm going to stick up for Petra here. I like Petra.
Petra's great, but there's a lot of people there. And there aren't as many tombs as there are the Nabataean tombs. There's way more in Alula. And they've taken an entirely different approach to their tourism there, where they're not going for mass tourism. They're going for exclusive tourism. And there are no ropes or barriers around any of the exhibits. And they have, instead of tour guides, they have rawi, which means storyteller. And so your entire experience is curated. It's the most out of this world break I've ever been on. It blew my mind. I've wanted to go back ever since, but it's so expensive.
Yes.
It's like Maldives plus prices for the hotels. It's really pricey.
Do they have normal hotels there or just posh five-star stuff?
So they have, they're calling them sort of, so they've got one called Habitas out there, but it's basically just posh. it's quality boutique five-star hotels, and that's the market they're going for. There's going to be a one and only out there. Is it a banyan tree? Is that what they're called, those hotels? They're going for high market. And all their storytellers, all their rawi have been trained, for example, by the Louvre. And there's a real French influence out there. So, yeah, it's on quality, not quantity, certainly, their tourism plan. But it's working because everyone I know wants to go. It's like a cross between Petra and the Grand Canyon with about 8 people in it. It's amazing.
And yours for just 30,000 dirhams for a weekend.
Yeah. You're looking, I do everything in pounds, don't I? So, 20,000. I'd say about that.
Okay, fine.
It's great. Yeah, I mean, it's not small beer. Yeah. It's not small beer.
Other stories that we're looking at this morning. You have been looking at people moving to Expo City, Dubai, Georgia, to work.
Yeah, I get very excited about Expo. I basically drank the Kool-Aid during Expo 2020 Dubai. And there was a lot of talk about whether or not there would be a legacy of this site. And so often we see it in Europe and other countries, especially, for example, Barcelona. The Olympic site there was an absolute white elephant for decades. I think it is finally coming alive now. But clearly
Milan, Expo site.
Milan, is it a
waste of space?
Real waste of space. Well, clearly the UAE learnt from that and they were going to have none of that in this country. And in fact, they have proven the point. We were wondering when all the sort of commercial tenants were going to start moving into the Expo 2020 site, and they now are. They've obviously carefully managed the sort of release of the news so that they can have a chunky number to announce. And they have now said that 3,000 people will be setting up, will be on site by September. Major companies, major multinationals, DP World, Emirates Airline, NG, who we had in the studio earlier this week, and Terminus Group, just among a few of them. But there's a real variety of companies heading in there as well.
And one of our colleagues, I think, is either thinking of moving out there or is moving out there.
She's signed, yeah.
Yeah.
Jennifer Crichton, producer of The Agenda, is moving to an apartment out there in a couple of months.
It's happening.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Let's get an outlook on global finance now, because while the IMF has announced that it does expect the UK to avoid recession, what about the UAE and the rest of the world? Also, will the US default on its debt and cause fiscal contraction? Will the recent bank wobble in Switzerland and the US lead to a financial crisis? And will we see contagion here in the Middle East? And if we are going to see contagion, what should we be doing with our money? To answer those questions and many more, delighted to say that we're now joined by the investment and market strategist, Henk Potts from Barclays Private Bank. Henk, good to have you back in the studio. How
are you? Good morning. Great to be back with you. I mean, that's an awful lot of questions to get through, isn't it? It just shows you the turmoil that's playing out in terms of the global economy, financial market. So certainly lots to talk about.
There really is. Let's start with a nice overview. Let's go with the umbrella. Your global economic outlook.
Well, listen, we always thought that 2023 was going to be a challenging year for the global economy. We had heightened geopolitical tensions, the ongoing impact of elevated levels of inflation on consumption, a tightening of financial conditions, of course, as interest rates have been ratcheted up. We were also concerned about stressed international relations. Activity could have been impacted by an escalation, I think, of the war in Ukraine. Actually, as the years progress, you have to say the political backdrop has probably been more stable than we would have anticipated at the start of the year. Certainly, economic data has proved to be far more resilient than anticipated. It's been helped by robust labour markets, benefiting from, of course, consumers that had excess savings that were built up during the course of the pandemic. It's been helping to cushion demand. Service sector has been recovering. We have become more optimistic, of course, around the outlook for China as the economy has reopened. But I still think you've got to be realistic, given many of the pressures that you're likely to see through the course of this year, certainly pressure on disposable incomes and consumers, particularly in advanced economies. I still think we are going to see a recession in the United States. There's still a risk of recession in the UK, although that has diminished. We are talking about probably anemic economic growth in Europe. So we think advanced economies will struggle to really generate meaningful growth during the course of this year and next. We expect advanced economies to grow by 0.8% this year and just 0.3% into 2024. So you see that sluggish performance continuing to play out over the course of the next 12 to 18 months.
Okay, let's get into a little bit more detail there. Specifically, let's look at the interest rates in the United States. Obviously, we're pegged. You know, whatever goes up there goes up here. Do you think those interest rates will continue to rise? And secondary question, do you think they need to, in your view?
I don't think they need to rise. Listen, I think the real focus for economists and probably for the Federal Reserve is what's happening in terms of labour markets, what's happening with inflation in the United States. Now, the US labour market, as you know, has been incredibly strong. Remember, the US economy has still created more than 250,000 jobs during the course of last month. Unemployment actually ticked down to 3.4% in April, which is the lowest that we've seen in 53 years. But if you look beyond those headline numbers, there are some signs that the US labour market is starting to weaken. If you look at a three-month average payroll figure, given the revisions we've seen to some of those previous numbers, now stands at 222,000 compared to 320,000 back in February. Over the course of the past few months, you've seen job openings starting to fall as well. So we think the labour market will cool. We've got US unemployment at 4.4% at the end of this year. Alongside that, inflation has been moderating in the United States. Remember, US inflation CPI came in at 4.9% for April. It's accelerated for 10 consecutive months, now back below 5% for the first time in 2 years. We think that's a trend that will continue. So we've got US CPI printing at 2.5% at the end of this year. And then we've got it averaging 2% during the course of next year. I think that would be a really relief to the Federal Reserve. So I think that 25 basis point hike that we saw in May is the end of the hiking cycle. We expect rates to be on hold for the rest of this year. Now, markets are starting to price in the idea we could see cuts. We do think we will see a pivot to an easing stance, but we don't think that will happen until 2024. But then as labour markets continue to cool, as inflation, as we've been talking about, moderates, as growth slows down, we expect 6 cuts from the Federal Reserve. Fed funds finishing next year at 3.5%.
So I've heard the Business Breakfast talk about this a lot. And Richard Dean, you've mentioned it many times. There's this sense that when you're trying to change the direction of something as massive as the US economy, there's a lag, there's a time lag. So you put in your interest rates rise, you don't see the effects for another how many months? How long is the
somewhere
lag?
Around 12 to 18 months is anticipated to shine through. Because if you think about it, interest rates rise. What does that mean for consumers? Well, it means for households, of course, mortgage rates increases. But lots of people on fixed rates rate mortgages. So it'll take some time for them to have to refinance to reset their mortgages. Loans take a little bit of time to come through. So you start to see this lagged effect coming through. But there are early signs, actually, the US consumer is now starting to feel that pain, feel that stress on disposable incomes, some of the momentum. Remember, the US consumer, the driving force behind its economy, counts more than 70% of activity. But early signs, I'd say, some of that momentum has been coming off. Retail sales were down in March, only a small recovery coming through in April. If you look at personal consumption expenditures, they stagnated during the course of the first quarter. So I think you are starting to see that. And that's part of the reason why we remain a little bit sanguine around growth prospects through the second half of this year and into 2024.
Is your feeling that the global economy and the people behind it, because, you know, the markets are ultimately run by, you know, personal sentiment, but just en masse. Do you think that they've got over the shock of the war in Ukraine and that initial knock-on effect on food and fuel prices?
Yeah, I think you are starting to see commodity markets stabilise. There's some good news around that. Certainly when it comes to the concerns around food and the supply of food, there's really issues, particularly in Northern Africa, about the potential impact that was going to have. I was in Egypt actually last week, and they are going through some difficult times. Food inflation is continuing to drive higher prices there. So there are some issues in parts of the world. There's no doubt about that. But the general shock has not been as bad as anticipated. Actually, the classic example of that is Europe. You remember coming into this year, there's real concerns about Europe's security of energy. Remember, it got 40% of its gas from Russia, so they were vulnerable to an embargo and from a rationing in terms of oil. Fortunately, Europe went into the peak winter demand season with high level of reserves. And as you know, the temperatures were much milder than anticipated. So if you look at European gas storage facilities, they're actually 60% full, which is 20 percentage points higher than the five-year average at this time of year. And actually, energy prices in Europe have come down a long way. European officials have done a really good job of replacing that Russian gas by importing liquefied natural gas. They've been boosting energy production from renewables as well. So if you look at European gas futures, which is a benchmark, I guess, for energy prices in Europe, currently you've been trading around 36 euros a megawatt hour, which is half of where we were at the start of the year. So that real fear around the supply of energy, the supply of food, actually hasn't been as severe as originally anticipated.
That is very encouraging, unusually positive. I wasn't expecting you to be so upbeat, Henk. It's really quite surprising. But there is still plenty of news for the markets to digest, yep. Not least those currently unresolved talks over the US debt ceiling. I know Richard's very keen to ask you about those, Henk, and whether or not that delay is likely to have a negative impact on the US and the global economy. But Henk, we are going to be keeping you with us into the next segment. So
very good.
There is an opportunity for people to send in questions as well, isn't there, Rich?
Lots of questions about investment. More questions, though. Is this the same Henk Potts who used to be on TalkSport Radio with Alan Brazil in the UK?
This is the same Henk Potts. Mr. Brazil is still going very well. I haven't done it for a little while, but I used to do a lot of those shows. A very lively, very bantery show. Nick Ferrari was the other big one, which we know very well in the studio, of course.
Everyone's
a few old friends from the past.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Our guest in the studio this morning is Henk Potts, market strategist at Barclays Private Bank, based in London, but a regular visitor to Dubai. Henk, thanks for sticking around.
Nice to be with you.
Loads of questions coming in. We'll get to those. Chet writes in, should crypto be part of a balanced portfolio?
We've done an awful lot of work on this. We've got these mathemageniuses who work in Switzerland, the quantitative guys, and they look at to see what an impact adding crypto to a portfolio would do. And even a small amount of crypto would blow out your risk budget. The reality is you could have crypto in a portfolio, but everything else would basically have to be cash in order to justify that. We don't think the risk-reward return on that makes much sense for our clients. I think they prefer much greater stability. As you know, we've always been pretty cautious around the outlook for cryptocurrencies. Quite frankly, as an investment strategy, it's very difficult for us to make a recommendation on it. Remember, it doesn't pay a dividend, doesn't generate a coupon, doesn't generate cash flows. Alongside that, you've got to deal with outside levels of volatility. There's concerns around security and all these other elements. So we continue to be pretty cautious about it.
So a related question from Khalil. He says, should I buy gold or Bitcoin? We've talked about cryptos, but what about gold?
Gold has actually been a pretty good performer during the course of this year. It's up around about 8.3%, I think, year to date. It's benefited from that safe haven status. People have been worried about the banks in the United States. We've seen falling bond yields, which creates less competition for gold, which, as you know, is a zero interest bearing asset. Alongside that, we've seen a weaker US dollar, so it makes it less expensive for international buyers and non-dollar denominated investors. So I think that's all been very supportive of gold. Alongside that, central banks continue to buy gold. And if you look at physical demand for gold, which is still an important category, actually been pretty robust, particularly in markets such as India and China, where the growth rates have been so much better. We think gold is a really important part of a portfolio. As a portfolio diversifier, allows you to take extra risk elsewhere, including higher levels of equity. But you should remember, gold is not going to drive your wealth long term. It's there to provide some stability in terms of it. I think many clients overestimate how much gold they should actually have. Our model suggests it should be a very low single digit amount.
You mentioned India there, strong physical demand for gold, the world's fastest growing major economy this year. 5.9%, yep, says the IMF. Sensex is at 62,000 points. Are you a buyer at that price?
Listen, I think the Indian economy is looking in good shape. There's no bad doubt about that. Domestic demand has been incredibly strong. They've benefited from this diversification away from China when it comes to manufacturing. Government policies have been very supportive, I think, of growth as well. Inflation has been moderating back in terms of the band. The Reserve Bank of India now expects to keep rates on hold for a prolonged period of time. I think when it comes to the Indian equity market, it's a really insider market. You've got to be really focused on the characteristics of the companies that you're looking to invest in. So I wouldn't say that we're buyers in terms of an index level, but we do narrow down. We've got a good team in India that's focusing on some of the opportunities within that market. But I think it's really about the specific companies as opposed to be buying the overall Indian market. And actually, the Indian stock market isn't necessarily a reflection in terms of the growth rate that you'd be seeing in terms of the underlying economy.
So India, the world's fastest growing major economy. Georgia, you've been looking at the world's weakest major economy, which is the UK.
I have a feeling I know where this is going.
Yeah, so the United Kingdom is going to avoid recession, so says the IMF. How long do you think that forecast is going to last?
Listen, if you remember at the start of this year, there was real concerns around the outlook for the UK economy. Most forecasts were very gloomy indeed. In fact, we were talking about a contraction of maybe 1% during the course of this year, the worst performing, you say, major economy. There was worries around the political turmoil at the end of last year, concerns around the fiscal, the monetary tightening that's been taking place, and the cost of living crisis that's been shining through. Now, the UK economy did grow in the first quarter of this year, but growth was pretty meagre. Remember, it was only 0.1%. There's a really sharp deceleration in terms of activity coming through in March. If you look at services, for example, had a very poor month, down 0.5%. For us, we continue to see those pressures on the consumers in the UK, and that's been shining through in weaker retail sales numbers. UK unemployment is now starting to rise. UK labour market has been robust, been rising over the course of the past few months, now up to 3.9%. 136,000 people lost their jobs during the course of last month. That's the first decline that we've seen since February 2021. So I think you're starting to see some of those pressures coming through. We think when it comes to the UK economy, inflation will moderate, but slower than we've been seeing elsewhere. We get inflation figures out later today. We expect CPI to be around 8.1% for April. Still some way to go in terms of, I think, the hiking cycle for the UK. We expect one more hike. We think the terminal rate for bank-based rates in the UK will be 4.75%. So in terms of our outlook for the UK economy, we expect it to flatline during the course of this year. Not a great performance, but certainly better than that contraction was expected. Then a very tepid recovery, growth just a 0.4% during the course of next year.
There's a real disconnect between the UK economy and, for example, the FTSE. And I only say that because the FTSE has been my only ETF that has actually performed in a good way.
Good place to be.
So how does that work? Because when you're looking at where to invest your money, you're hearing that the UK economy isn't doing very well, and yet somehow the FTSE
is doing absolutely well. Right. Despite the fact, as you say, we're pretty cautious around the prospects for the UK economy, we do like UK equity markets. Number one, valuations have been cheaper in the UK. They still trade on a 12% discount to their 20-year average. It's also about the sector makeup in terms of the UK. You've got the banks, you've got the energy companies, you've got the pharmaceutical companies in there. But remember, these are big international companies. These are companies that operate on the global stage, that have lots of international earnings that they're bringing back into pounds and into the UK. So that makes them look more attractive. The dividend is also attractive in the UK, around about 3.5%. So I think it's a good place to invest. Maybe the economy's been struggling, though.
This might be our last interview with you, Henk, because your job is going to be wiped out by ChatGPT. I'm reading on ZDNet, a survey of 2,000 Americans conducted by the Motley Fool. 47% of US adults reported using ChatGPT to get investment advice. What do you make of this?
It's a bit of a concern, and we have looked at that and we've reviewed some of the results that you get from these engines. They have become far more powerful, there's no doubt about that, taking advantage of databases around the world. But the reality is, I think you've got to put them in some sort of context. They're still not at the point that will give you strong advice or personal advice. And getting to the point of allowing you to translate that into making investment decisions is not there yet, it has to be said. So I think it's going to be a tool that analysts will be able to embrace, will be able to enhance our work by using it. I don't think it's going to replace us. Knock, knock.
We're knocking too. Don't you worry. They've got voice rep. They can replicate our voices, and then they'd speak without any umps.
You can't change personality, though. You can't bring that in, and that's what you guys have got.
We've got 60 seconds left with you. Balanced portfolio at the moment. What does it look like?
More balanced, it has to be said. Equities are an important component of that. We know that's going to be driving the long-term wealth for many of our clients. But given the fact we've seen a rapid increase in terms of interest rates, we think fixed income have become far more attractive. But you've got to be careful. You've got to be taking advantage of this point, because the reality is you've got to be locking in rates, because as we've been talking about, interest rates will start to fall, the yields will become less attractive. So it's using this opportunity to be in fixed income.
Henk Potts of Barclays Private Bank. Great talk. You appreciate your time this morning.
Pleasure.
Right, let's keep the lawyers happy.
Dubai Eye 103.8 presents an array of independent expert opinions and does not advise one particular view. Always seek independent legal advice which considers your own personal circumstances. Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Yeah, looking now at an important fintech-based story, because payments company Checkout.com has been granted a retail payment services license from the Central Bank of the United Arab Emirates. Now, this makes it the first global payments provider to be granted a permit of this sort. Now, the only other licensed entities in this vein are banks. Now, you might remember Checkout.com back when it made headlines in January last year, when a $1 billion fundraising round basically meant that the relatively new startup was valued at $40 billion. Yep, that's with a B. And its founder lives here in Dubai, as does our next guest, Rimo Giovanni Abondalo, the general manager for the Middle East and North Africa for Checkout.com. Rimo joins us in the studio. Thank you so much for coming in. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so tell me a little bit more about Checkout.com. It's already used by the brands that we know, you know, things like Careem, OSN, Starbucks, Cafu, amongst others. They use your services to process payments already. So what difference is this license going to make?
Sure. So Checkout.com is a global online payment service provider. So as you rightly say, every day as a consumer, we interact with Checkout when we buy food on Talabat, when we order grocery on Instant Shop, on Carrefour. We do fuel refuel with credit cards, with Cafu. So we've been in the region for nearly 10 years, processing for some of the largest global payment company. They're coming to the region, as well as helping domestic businesses to expand. The license has been an awesome news for the ecosystem. We are the first global fintech company granted this license. What does it mean? We are able to offer end-to-end payment solution to the merchants without using any third party in the middle, and ultimately help us to give better service, higher quality, and faster results as well when it comes to performance.
Okay, so which organisations normally hold these licences? To give us a sense of why it's so extraordinary that you've managed to get one.
We are a payment company. We started in 2012 in the UK. We expanded very quickly in the Middle East. It's a region we know very well since we opened the office in the UAE since nearly 10 years. Historically, banks, they own acquiring license, the ability to process payments by credit card, notably with Visa, MasterCard. And the recent development of the regulators in this country allow fintech companies as well to process payments. And that's exactly what we managed to achieve. We managed to replicate a key success story in other regions, in other countries, also in the UAE. And we are very proud to be selected as the first for this awesome news.
Okay, so before you had this license, your payment system had to go through the banks. And what was the impact of that process on your business?
Performance really matters when it comes to payments. If you look at things such as like yours and my DNA, 99.9% is the same, but yet we are very different people. And payments is really about performance, it is about data. And having the ability to control everything in one go, in one single platform, without a third party, it's ultimately a better experience for the merchant, hence for the end customer. And when you make a transaction on the website, speed, ability to accept the transactions obviously matter to you as a consumer and matter for the merchant, which they give the ability to accept more transactions at a higher cost. So overall, it's a better quality, a lower cost.
I have to say, I think the amount of times that I put things in a checkout basket and come close to buying them, come close to spending money on somebody's website, and then the payment system is messed up and then you get distracted, and then what do you know, you don't spend the money. I mean, what sort of services are you expected to be able to offer to your merchants now that you couldn't before? I mean, you said speed, but is there anything else? I mean, the problem is it's quite technical, isn't it?
It is very technical, but the ultimate results, I want to make sure that every time you put something on the cart, you manage to go ahead and purchase. You might to make sure that, you know, it's less friction for you as a consumer, and there is overall a better experience for the merchant. But without going too much technical, I think what is really matters is the ability to offer a better service. We know there is a lot of merchants, they've been underserved in this country, or they receive the service that, you know, it's not necessary as peer compared to more mature markets. And it's really helping us to serve the merchants better, giving like better capabilities, and most importantly, ensuring that some of the features when it comes to payments, which is enabling new payment methods, as well as the ability to support merchants with business expansion, it's possible much easier and quicker. Also for new companies, they want to start business online.
How come you guys can do it better than the banks?
Because we are a fintech. We started in the fintech world. We definitely have the DNA of a fintech company. The business has been growing organically since the last 10 years. And most importantly, you know, we are very merchant focused. We are very consumer focused. That's exactly what makes us very different. And that's why we've been very focused in solving complex problems, because payments is very fragmented. Behind your card payments and your item you put on the card, there is an incredible amount of infrastructure that goes from sending the payment request to Visa, MasterCard, making sure that, you know, you are the cardholder, there is no fraudulent transaction on that card. It's very, very complex. And obviously, the more technical it goes, the more it should live in the hands of people that really know what they're talking about.
There's been a lot made of fintech companies such as yours, you know, that valuations have really been quite heady, not least, you know, back in January 2022. I keep on coming back to it, but the valuation of $40 billion for checkout.com. And you're not the only fintech company getting amazing sort of valuations along those lines. Things have slipped recently. You know, they at the end of 2022, the valuation slipped to $11 billion. What's your outlook for the future of these fintech companies such as yours and the market more widely?
I think it's very clear that the world continues to go in one direction. The one direction is, you know, more digital, and there is more payments. I mean, if you look at specifically in the UAE, we see from the data of some recent reports we have done, we see three main trends. One is that, you know, people continue to shop more online. 96% of the people in the UAE, they shop online, and 40% of them, they do at least once per week. The second trend we see that people continue to shop online and they use a digital payment solution to pay. And last but not least, we see more foreign companies coming in. So at the end of the day, we continue to see amazing opportunities in the digital ecosystem, and specifically in terms of online payments. And companies like Checkout.com, they have the duty to continue to empower business to thrive in the digital economy.
Remy Giovanni Abundandalo, thank you so much. Really interesting to speak to you today. General Manager for the Middle East and North African region for Checkout.com.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.